Hello, everybody. Welcome to Beyond Awakening, the Future of Spiritual Practice. I'm Terry Patton, the founder of this series and your host. And tonight we're going to be continuing this remarkable international conversation about the future of spiritual practice with Sadhguru Jaggi Vasudev, who will be joining us live from Coimbatore, India. Thank you, you who have turned in, for participating in this conversation and inquiry sincerely and seriously. We're in a sincere and serious way intending to serve the evolution of consciousness and culture by deepening the dialogue about how spirituality can evolve to help us rise to the challenges of our time and create a cultural context for a transition to a sustainable human presence on our planet. We've already engaged a whole series of probing and enlivening conversations that have catalyzed all of us. And tonight I'm honored to be joined in conversation by Sadhguru Jaggi Vasudev in a conversation that he's entitled Inner Engineering. Sadhguru is the real thing, a very contemporary spiritual teacher who's deeply founded in ancient wisdom. He awakens spontaneously outside any tradition, but in many ways he's the incarnation of India's ancient spiritual traditions. I heard about him first from friends who are serious lifelong students of the path, so I investigated and viewed quite a number of his talks via online video, and I was surprised and impressed. He's bold and witty and eloquent in English, not derivative, a true original. He quickly cuts through to the essence of things playfully and directly and in ways that are not a repeat of what you've heard before. My friend's comments that impressed me the most was that what they valued most was not just his insight and eloquence, but they thought that was secondary. What they valued most about him was that he transmits a powerful force field of subtle spiritual energy and blessings. His name, Sadhguru, means true guru or highest guru, the embodiment of truth. And he's revered by his disciples as an enlightened rishi or saint whose life's purpose is to guide the initiated on the spiritual path to self-realization or God-realization, you know, revealing the form of the formless. Sadhguru is just as much at home in a loincloth in the Himalayas as he is wearing blue jeans and straddling a motorcycle on the freeway. He flows freely between teaching people about the most mundane, ordinary aspects of life and the high subtleties of yoga. He founded the Isha Foundation, and under his guidance, the Isha Foundation has launched a number of large-scale spiritual, humanitarian, and environmental projects, one of which is to plant a million trees in India. And as many as 800,000 people gather for his spiritual celebrations. Every year he does teach in America, especially through the center that the Isha Foundation has in Tennessee. And he'll be conducting an intensive retreat this coming February in Los Angeles. So welcome, Sadhguru. It's an honor to have you with us this evening. I guess early tomorrow, your time, so you're joining us from the future.
Thank you, Terry. I very much appreciate that because you said it's beyond. So I am from the future right now for you.
Well, great. Well, you know, I wanted to just begin our conversation where we've kind of begun each of these dialogues, which is with this core question that we're asking. On one of your online video talks, I noticed you were saying that the way to change the world is to raise consciousness. Maybe you can just kind of begin at the beginning and explain why that's so.
First of all, when we say consciousness, we need to understand what it means. Consciousness is not a bunch of thoughts or emotions or a certain level of understanding. When we say consciousness, we are talking about a dimension which is beyond the physicality of who we are. When we say physicality, the nature of the physicality is that it exists within boundaries. the very fundamental of physicality is that it is defined by the definition of its boundary. A defined boundary is the basis of physicality. Without a defined boundary, there can be no physicality. So when we say consciousness, we are talking about a dimension which defeats boundaries or which is beyond boundaries. So right now, we have reached a point in the history of human existence on this planet where we have the necessary resource, capability, and technology to address almost every human problem on the planet. Problems of nourishment, problems of health, education, you name it. We can address almost everything. At the same time, we have also reached a point where it does not take some natural calamity. Human beings, out of their own actions, can destroy the very planet on which they exist. Both these things are possible. It is only a question of, do we operate on this planet, you versus me, or do we exist in harmony with the existence that is here? Harmony is possible only when we raise beyond our physicality, because when we exist within the identity of being physical, naturally it is going to be you versus me, because physicality is about boundaries. And now when we have immense capabilities, with which we can either find solutions or create problems for which there will be no solution, it's extremely important that there is consciousness, which means there is an existence, human existence, beyond boundaries. If this doesn't happen, there is every possibility that we will work towards our own destruction and demise. Right now, the human predicament is not of its incapability. Right now, our very intelligence and competence has become our problem and our curse. If human intelligence and competence becomes a problem, if the very what we consider as success becomes a problem in our life, then we are really looking towards a life where we will have to seek failure. We are looking towards life where we have to curb our own intelligence and competence. So consciousness is definitely the only answer you have, because unless there is a more inclusive experience within a human being, unless a human being begins to experience himself beyond the limitations of his boundaries, and all boundaries have been set because of his identification with the physical, and if this identity with the physical is not transcended, then there is really not much hope for human existence on the planet.
Hello. And therefore, the work that you do with your many students is part of this healthy response that can bring hope and is part of your purpose in your work?
The essential nature of what I do is mainly to disperse technologies through which a human being can transcend the limitations of the physical. The goal is not to save the planet, but it is a natural consequence of consciousness. The goal is to set people on the path of knowing their true nature. Once that happens, if human beings realize their original nature of being beyond the physicality. When I say their original nature, what we call as the physical, which is essentially our body and then translates into our mind, is an accumulation. The body that we carry is an accumulation of the food that we have eaten. The mind that we carry is an accumulation of the impressions that we have taken in. So, what we accumulate can be ours, but can never be us. So this distinction, if it arises within the human experience, what is me and what is mine? If this mix-up does not happen within the human experience, then he begins to experience the original nature of who he is, which is a boundless possibility and boundless nature. So the purpose is to bring people to the fulfillment of knowing the truth of their existence, and the well-being of the planet and humanity is a natural consequence out of this truth.
When we convened this series, part of it came from the fact that quite a number of us, and myself included, you know, have been serious spiritual practitioners for 10, 20, 30 years. And we began the path with this sense that the problems of the world couldn't be addressed at the level of consciousness that we and everyone was living, that we needed to transform our consciousness to be part of a healthy response, a real address to the problems we saw accumulating in the world. And after these years of practice, many of us are saying, okay, how now can our practice enable us to really shift things? What can we do? How can our practice evolve, or how can our sincerity and our seriousness and our integrity be effective in a broader way? Is there anything you'd want to say to us asking that question specifically?
The nature of consciousness is such that it need not necessarily be entangled with one's action. The question that you're asking right now is like, if a flower blossoms, how a flower has to think how to spread this fragrance. I don't think that's a relevant question. The important thing is the flower has to blossom. If the flower blossoms, the fragrance will spread. But if the flower had a voice, it could also bring the joy of being seen, the beauty of it being seen by people. So it has to position itself right where it can be seen. If it intends that the fragrance is good enough, then it need not position itself anywhere. It need not do any right kind of action. But if it intends that it wants people not only to enjoy its fragrance, but also its beauty, then it has to position itself.
Mm,
does
beautiful.
That make sense to you?
Yeah, it's a beautiful metaphor too. I really appreciate that. I see that. I think that that's part of my own experience. And yet there's a sense that the natural spiritual fragrance of our lives of practice, even when it is somewhat evident in our lives that we've changed and that people around us are affected by that, somehow we do feel like the world needs to turn a new corner, that there's a particularly fraught time, and that somehow we need to come together in a new way, or that spirituality needs to find a new level of traction in order to assert the kind of transformational shifts that seem like they're necessary. Are there any special responsibilities or special opportunities or special, you know, every time, I suppose, has its unique challenge and opportunity. Are there any aspects of what we're facing right now that you would want us to be especially aware of, flowers that we are?
The uniqueness of the situation in which we exist is we are seeing the expression of human intelligence and competence at its highest and at its most disastrous. So an unconscious intelligence is more destructive than productive. All the science and technology, which should have been the greatest boon that humanity ever stumbled upon, unfortunately has turned into a curse only because of unconscious handling of this. If there was a higher level of consciousness in people who conduct these things, then definitely... Hello?
Yes, we're hearing you loud and clear, not quite as loud as we'd like. Everybody, please understand that Sadhguru is joining us from India, so his voice isn't quite as loud as we'd like, but I think everyone's able to hear you pretty well. There was a little click on the line, Sadhguru, but we're doing fine. And we hear the peacocks in the background, too.
Sorry?
And we hear the peacocks in the background, too.
Yeah, they wake me up every day, very early. So this is the human predicament right now. It is their own ability which has turned into a problem. If you are suffering problems of incapability, that was different. Now you are suffering problems of capability. So this is not a good thing. Now you are not suffering the problems of failure. You are suffering the problems of success. So this definitely needs to be addressed right now, and a more focused address is needed. So, for example, the projects that we are doing has been a serious awakening in this part of the world. So it is the ecological movement, the movement for education and health, these things have become, it's the largest ecological movement in India right now, where, ordinary people have come out and planted more than 10 million trees right now, and they've changed the landscape of the place by doing this. So this action was, nobody has given up their life to make this happen. This is just out of awareness that people have acted with such purpose, sense of purpose, that such results can be achieved with very little investment in terms of time and resource.
Mm-hmm.
So whatever the problems we have created, we also have the necessary capability and intelligence to find solutions for this if only there was a little more elevation in the consciousness of the people who are in positions of power and responsibility on the planet. So one of the most important things to do right now is, that people who occupy positions of power and responsibility across the world need to be exposed to the possibility of experiencing their own lives beyond the boundaries of their physical identity.
That experience of our larger identities has been, I think, a huge inspiration and motivator to many of the thousands of people who are participating in this series of conversations. And we've had some very rich conversations about how in a conversation like this, where two people are talking, the two people enter into a field of shared awareness, and our mutual understanding can maybe beckon new understanding or new inspiration out of the field. But it's even more powerful in a group sometimes when a whole group enters into a higher state of consciousness together. And I know in your work, you transmit spiritual initiation to individuals and groups very powerfully, and that the spiritual realization that you speak out of is a deep seeing into the subtle and causal physics of the nature of reality out of which we're all manifesting. I wonder if you see that this dynamic of the subtle and causal fields is an aspect of how change will appear. Is there something in the exposure of those powerful individuals to these realities, but also perhaps the changes in the field itself that can affect those people and other people? Or is the plane of action primarily right here in the gross physical realm where we talk and speak and have phone conversations, or is it just as importantly on those inner planes?
No, the external action is equally important in the world today because, extending the previous metaphor, if there is fragrance of the flower in the air, there may be a whole lot of people in the world who are right now insensitive enough to ignore the fragrance. You have to bring the flower in front of their eyes. Otherwise, they will not even notice it. It does not matter how beautiful or strong the fragrance is. Right now, as I sit here in the morning, I smell rain in the air. And I'm sure almost every creature around here smells rain in the air, but not many human beings do. They are busy with their own thing, or they're sleeping still, or maybe they smell coffee, but not rain in the air. So it is action, physical action is equally important and relevant in today's world.
Yeah. I know we're focused on that. A lot of our conversation has to do with what is the form of spiritual activism that we can bring ourselves to, really appreciating that most of us are in the United States or in Europe where we're relatively privileged, relatively wealthy and educated and probably, consuming more resources than most people are in India. And we feel the responsibility to be in some way part of the change, part of the shift that can bring a different kind of balance to the world. I know you have students in India and in the United States, and you probably see differences between them. And I'm curious what those differences are and how that results in, what are the instructions or the suggestions or the even the blessings, that are peculiar to the Westerners that feel most important to communicate.
See, when people get used to a certain level of comfort and usage, if you ask them to look at it, they understand this as downgrading of their life, which is the struggle that lots of Western societies are going through right now with a little bit of economic downturn. And also, the way they're trying to deny, many of the people are trying to simply deny the reality of ecological disaster looming in the near future. So the very nature of human beings are always that they want to pass the buck to somebody else, and they believe someone else is going to do it, or maybe the future generation will do it, it's not our business, and this kind of thing. So, actually, this happened in 2008 when I was at the World Economic Forum. When just the recession had hit, when I went there, I saw these economic leaders who, this little over 2,000 economic leaders who control almost 80% of the world's economy. Most of them were in a depressed condition that the economic downturn has happened. And we also had a session called Recession and Depression. So I was to address this session and I said the recession is bad enough, you don't have to be depressed on top of it. Nobody is hungry here, nobody is gone without food. No such thing has happened. And above all, the very way we have structured our economy is that the way we, you have structured the economy of the world is such that if it does not work, we will be depressed. If it works, we'll be damned. So today, the whole world in many ways, knowingly or unknowingly, trying to fashion their life according to like the standards of what is available for an average citizen in the United States. That's become the aspiration of the world, and everybody is working towards it. Now, we have reached a point where it's almost a crime to wish them success, because the living planet says, the living planet, which has become an authority, a kind of an authority on information and ecological situations on the planet, says that if all the close to 7 billion people on the planet achieve the standard, average standard that the American citizenry has reached, then we need 4.5 planets, but we have only one. So definitely this needs to be looked at, that life needs to be arranged in a different way than the way we have tried to arrange it till now. This happens, this is not about the American lifestyle. This naturally happens to a human being everywhere. Once they have one thing, they want to have another. Once they have the other, the next thing. Because this is a spiritual longing that a human being is trying to reach towards his boundlessness through physical means. So his longing is perfectly fine. It is just the method that he's employing is a hopeless method. When people desire for more and more, they are not desiring for money or property or comfort. What they're desiring for is a certain expansion to their life. So if that expansion happens, they want little more expansion and little more. So when people are seeking an endless expansion to their life, it is very clear that they are looking for boundlessness. There is something within every human being which does not like boundaries. So if a person is imprisoned in 5x5 cubicle, he will feel horribly imprisoned. And if you liberate him into 10x10 cubicle, he'll feel great for a day and again, very terribly imprisoned. Then if you release him into something like 100x100, he'll feel wonderful for 3 days and once again feels imprisoned. It doesn't matter how large a boundary you provide him with. The moment he realizes that he is within the boundary, there is something within him which longs to go beyond that. So there is something within the nature of the human being, the very consciousness which is the basis of his existence, which constantly is aspiring to be boundless. Only problem is right now, he is seeking to reach his boundlessness through physical means, not understanding the very nature of physicality is boundary. Not understanding the very definition of physicality is a defined boundary in itself. So the longing to expand, the longing to become boundless is there in every human being. The work is essentially to make him understand that physicality is not the right currency to go in the direction. So all the, what we call as exploitation, what we call as ostentatious life, for the person who is involved in it, it feels like very normal and it feels like a necessity. There was a time when we were walking, when as human beings we just walked this planet, and that was fine if you could walk. Then we found a bicycle, and if everybody had a bicycle, then we thought bicycle is a must. Without it we cannot live. Now we have a car and we think that's a must. Now people are about to, you know, moving towards everybody having a private jet, and now we think that's a must. So this is a natural way a human mind works, that it wants to expand. This is not a commentary on any particular society. This is the way every human being exists. It is just that maybe certain societies have gone ahead of the others in doing that and have clearly shown that it doesn't work. We did not need this demonstration. It is just within the framework of human intelligence to understand this. But we have demonstrated that it doesn't work, and it cannot work.
when I contemplate that, I see the stuckness that, you know, has troubled me all along, and yet I know in my heart I feel just a hunch of optimism. I don't accept the idea of the stuckness, even though these patterns are so profound and seeming in some ways to be so intractable. And I know in some of the talks that you have given that I've viewed and listened to, you've expressed an optimism that the future will be good. Please talk about that and explain something about how your optimism relates to the kinds of stucknesses and problems that you've just been pointing to.
The problems are not of the planet. The problems are of humanity. The problems were created by us. So definitely we can also find solutions. The problems are not beyond us. We can find solutions to these situations. The question is, will we do that in time? Will we do that consciously, or will we be forced to do it by nature in a very cruel manner? That's all the question is. I would like to see that we do it consciously, joyfully, rather than nature forcing us to do it in a very cruel manner. For example, the scientific data, creates a very gloomy picture of tomorrow. But that's the reason why people who are working in the field of consciousness need to come together and work towards raising a situation within the human mind, because always predictions of tomorrow are made with cold facts. Nobody takes into account what's beating in the human heart. Nobody takes into account what is human aspiration. So all cold facts can be defeated if human aspiration is changed, if human intention is moved from problem to solution, which can be done, and that's what we need to work towards.
I know part of what shifts for me is that I have this sense that when I look at it from outside, I'm just following the trends and imagining where the trends will lead. But when I feel my own commitment as a participant, it's as though I move from watching the action on the field, like watching from the stands in a sporting match, and then I get down on the field and I realize that I have the ball in my hands in some ways, and I begin to feel a creative relationship to the whole matter. And for me, this is a big source of optimism, just my own presumption of my own responsibility and my own participation. And for me, that's a spiritual act, that shift. What do you think of that?
See, I think the present situation neither needs optimism nor pessimism. What it needs is realism, which is always the necessity. So the essence of consciousness is just this, that one's mind can be either optimistic or pessimistic. The nature of consciousness is that it simply sees what is there. So this is the very fundamental of being conscious, that you simply see everything the way it is, not the way you think it is. So when we say I'm an optimist, or when we say I'm a pessimist, these are conclusions that we have drawn from what we see, but not what we see. So the most important thing right now is for every human being, or at least those people who can make, who have the necessary power and capability to make a certain level of impact in the world, to see the reality of who we are and where we are. And this can turn everything around. So is this an optimistic statement? No, I'm just saying it is possible. But between possibility and reality, there is always a distance. Are we going to walk it? That's a big question.
Well, I know that your someone who cares deeply and who participates with a big, big impact on an awful lot of people's lives. And the focus of a lot of your work is on what you call inner engineering, and that was what you chose for the title of the conversation we're having right now. Does this whole idea of inner engineering represent an intelligent response to the whole situation that you've just described and laid out? How does it connect and help us understand what it is?
See, let's understand what I call as inner engineering is, see, essentially the word engineering means that we want to have situations the way we want it. We have engineered the planet in so many different ways because we want to have it the way we want it. So in trying to have the planet the way we want it, we have brought it to a brink where, certain things are under threat. Now, if we try to engineer the world the way we want it, if we try to engineer the people and the situations around us the way we want it, one thing that we will realize is it does not matter how hard you try, you cannot even have one person exactly 100% the way you want him or her to be. I don't think any human being has ever encountered another human being 100% just the way they want them to be, because that's the very nature of existence. Nobody happens 100% the way you want them. But is it not important at least you happen 100% the way you want yourself to be? So inner engineering is about this dimension. This is the only thing. When it comes to the outside situations comprise of millions of ingredients. Not all of it will ever fall into place 100% the way an individual person will want it to be. But when we talk about the inner situation, there is only one entity. And this one entity can very easily happen 100% the way you want it to be. If this one happened exactly the way you want it to be, you would definitely keep it in utmost pleasantness. Because this is human aspiration. Every human being wants to experience life in as much pleasantness as possible. This pleasantness may be described by a different word. We may call it peace, we may call it happiness, we may call it joy, bliss, ecstasy, love, or success. All these things are just different levels of pleasantness. So when the option comes, do you want pleasantness or unpleasantness, every human being definitely wants pleasantness for himself. Right now, only about what he wants for his neighbor may be debatable, but what he wants for himself is definitely pleasantness. Once a human being is feeling truly pleasant within himself, irrespective of what's happening around him, then it is very natural for him to find pleasant expressions to himself. If you meet any human being when he is very happy, you will see he is the most wonderful person that you can meet. If you meet the same human being when he is unhappy or frustrated or something else, which is some level of unpleasantness within himself, he will naturally want to share his unpleasantness with you, and that's when he could be nasty. So the very nature of what a human being is has not been engineered the way he wants it to be, and it can easily be engineered not from outside, but only by that person. So inner engineering is an opportunity and a possibility. It is offered as a technology for inner well-being. These are technologies for well-being. This is a product of a very deep understanding, a scientific understanding of how human mechanism functions. This is about changing the very chemistry of who you are. You can create a chemistry of blissfulness within yourself. So is bliss a goal by itself? No. If you are blissful by your own nature, then you are no more an issue. You cannot handle any issue in the necessary context when you yourself are an issue. So once you cease to be an issue in your own life, then your ability to handle the outside is so hugely enhanced. One has to go through the experience to believe what I'm saying. Because once you cease to be an issue, you will see you are a natural solution to everything around you.
This process of flow, of real surrender and co-creative, loving connectedness to the larger world and the larger flows and larger processes of life are aspects, I think, of the actually my spiritual path and those of many of the people who are joining us today. And aspects of that have to do with the breaking up of the fixation of attention at the gross level, the mental level, the emotional level, so that we open into a spaciousness and a vastness, into a subtle dimensions of reality and even perhaps causal. And although you don't, you usually talk in a very pragmatic way, not so much about the esoteric aspects of yoga. I know these are aspects of what people experience in their work with you, and I'd be interested if you'd be willing to talk maybe a little more more directly about this deeper level of spirituality and of the way that you serve people who are your students and disciples.
I have always crafted myself to be logically 100% correct in everything that I say. Why I'm saying this has been the most crippling factor for human consciousness to spread, that when people who consider themselves logically correct or scientific in their approach, they all who are considered in many ways as the intelligent part of humanity have completely rejected spiritual processes on the planet on many levels, mainly because they cannot accept anything which does not appeal to their logic. This has been the beauty of the work that I do, that my approach, the whole program, is so logically correct that you can't pick any kind of a logical hole in it. But at the end of it, you will see people in the most illogical situation. Right now, I'm touring the state where I'm living, here, which is the Tamil Nadu, the southernmost state in India. So almost every town that I go to, like in large cities, there are 100,000 people gathered for the evening meetings. In smaller cities, there is something between 30 to 50,000. In the smaller, much smaller towns, we have like 15 to 20,000 people gathered wherever we go. So these packed crowds, where I spend only 2.5 hours with them. In these 2.5 hours, you have to see to believe this. You have to, you know, those videos are probably now, maybe they will go on the YouTube or something. So you will see more than 80% of the people who have assembled there will be in tears of blissfulness and ecstasy. They are seeing us for the very first time. They have not gone through any program. And I am not talking any kind of flowery things to them. I'm not talking about love. I'm not talking about togetherness, nothing. I'm just talking very cutting logic, but still the end result is just that. So what I'm trying to tell you is, see, if you want flowers in your garden, you don't have to think flowers and talk flowers. If you want flowers in your garden, you have to think soil, you have to think manure, you have to think water, you have to think sunlight. Nothing romantic about any one of them. But still, that is how flowers happen.
And the offering that that you would suggest to to us is to simply relax into the blissful nature of existence directly? Is there, in what ways can this beautiful vision and the clarity of your voice, how can that translate into a shift for someone listening right now? How can this be, how can we receive the gift of your transmission right here, right now, most fully and most authentically? How can we participate to really make this as full and real and transformative as it could possibly be?
The most important thing is if one wants to have some kind, if they want to be touched by something beyond the logic of what I'm speaking, because you need to understand this. Logic is a process which divides everything. Logical approach to anything is nothing short of a dissection. But the nature of the consciousness is to perceive everything in its fullest unity and grandeur of the way existence is. So how do these two things connect? It is the logic of one's mental process. It is human logic which separates him from the existence and the source of creation. Right now, as you speak to me, what did you have for lunch, Terry?
Let's see, I had... I just had a snack of bananas and almond butter and some rice cakes.
Okay, bananas. So if you eat bananas, you don't go bananas, do you?
No. Not today, anyway.
So you eat a banana. In a matter of a few hours, you are transforming this banana into a human being.
Yeah, that's right.
These bananas are not sitting in your stomach as bananas anymore. They are largely become human right now. So you are quite a miracle maker, Terry. You can make bananas into human beings. And almost everybody is, that you eat a piece of bread or a banana and you transform that into a human being. When I say human being, I'm talking about today, technologically, people are very excited about the gadgets that they're looking at, their phones, their computers, and their cars, and spacecraft, and whatever else. But all the gadgets that you have on the planet were created by this gadget, which you call as the human mechanism. And people are very, very, I see a huge excitement when a new iPhone comes in the market or something, but the most tremendous gadget, which is I itself, is being completely missed. Because here you have a certain intelligence and competence right now within you, which is capable of transforming a banana into a human being. The very source of creation is throbbing within you. So the opportunity and the possibility for every human being is either to exist here as just a piece of creation or to exist here as the source of creation. So both of these things exist within us. Right now, the piece of creation is the body and the mind, but that which created this also exists within us. So shifting from being a piece of creation to the source of creation is the whole process of inner engineering. So right now, what can they do to experience this? Well, you can't transmit the method, but you don't have to go by the method. There is, the methods are only because people are logically entangled in their mind. To unentangle them, you need a method, a scientific process. But if they are willing to just even as much as listen, I can just do a chant which can do things for people? Did I?
Well, I would be grateful to sit and listen to that chant, and I hope many of our listeners would too, if you'd be willing to do that.
Good Buddha, Karuna Tarim, Samsara Sarim, Bhujagendra Harim, Sada Vasantam. Hridaya Ravindhe Bhavam Bhavani Sahitam Namami Sahitam Namami Sahitam Namami Sahitam Namami.
Thank you.
And the problem is the birds are trying to sing along with me.
Well, it felt to me like I was there with you. Not a problem. I think maybe dropping into this deeper level of resonance, the goodwill and the care and the gratitude that are there in all of our human hearts are perhaps aligned in a different way. And one of the things that we've been talking about a lot is we've had conversations among people who are spiritual teachers about how different communities of spiritual practice can, in a sense, become members of a larger metta community, a metta sangha, we were sometimes calling it, and that everyone can be a blesser or teacher and a student of everyone else in a larger field of love and deeper profundity and resonance.
Definitely that needs to happen. Definitely that needs to happen. In India, we're making an effort right now, a serious effort, to bringing all the spiritual processes together on one platform. A similar thing needs to happen in the world too.
We are sometimes interested to, some people are very much students of a particular teacher, but many people are venturing into this territory and feeling almost more like co-venturers, coming to teachers not necessarily to become devotees or disciples, but to simply give and receive and resonate together with a sense that something larger may be the trend of consciousness in our time, and that perhaps we can contribute in a different way, and maybe as co-venturers we can evoke a shift in the inner planes at some level. I've certainly been feeling that in this conversation I'm hoping to convene a greater sense of resonance and depth and commitment and maybe a service to something greater than ourselves. And certainly we do that in a way that's, we try to do it intelligently and logically, but not in a way that's bound to a merely rational and logical approach. How does that feel to you? Are there different modalities to what you're doing in India from what might be happening here? How can we be involved in this together, and what, you know, perhaps you might even want to offer some leadership, or maybe you just are open to it. I'm not sure. You know, how might that cooperative evolution of a meta spiritual community be moved forward right here and now?
It's definitely really important to make people understand that spiritual process is not like a religious divide. A spiritual process is about inclusiveness of the existence. So a spiritual seeker is somebody, when you refer to yourself as a seeker, in opposition to referring to yourself as a believer, what you are saying is that essentially you do not know, so you're seeking. Only one who sees I do not know can be a genuine seeker. Otherwise, it is just trying to prove yourself right. So when one is a seeker, it is important that if he finds a certain place, if he finds a certain method is working for him and he trusts that method, it is best that he dig as deep as he can in that method rather than shopping all over the place. But at the same time, because today the world is not, world and communities and people are no more isolated situations, because we have enough communication to go across the globe, it is important that all spiritual groups are presented as possibilities for individual seekers to seek from whatever they feel most comfortable with. At the same time, it is also important that people do not go spiritual shopping or spiritual hopping, because then it will lose its profoundness, because people will start doing this for entertainment, shifting from one thing to another, which will be a waste of time and energy for the teacher and for the seeker. So bringing all the groups on one platform, as we are trying to do right now in India, is a good thing to do in the world, so that all of it is available in one place, so that people who seek will seek with whatever they are most comfortable with. At the same time, spiritual adventurers who are moving from place to place, not picking up anything of profoundness, picking up only things intellectually without coming to any profound experience within themselves, is an unfortunate waste of time. Having come in touch with something valuable, you shouldn't move away. You should dig deeper. It is like, if you want to dig a well, you have to continue to dig in one place till you hit water. If you keep shifting from place to place, you'll end up digging small holes all over the place, but not fulfill the purpose for which you dug the well. So if we understand this distinction, there is no problem at all, and it must happen that all spiritual groups should be represented on one platform. That is definitely a need, otherwise it would be perceived as a kind of a divide. It is not a divide. It is more a question of a practical aspect. To take one to a certain level of profoundness, a certain seclusion is needed, but that is not a divide.
Yeah, beautiful. Well, there's one last question I'd like to ask before we open it up to questions from others, which is, as a guru in the guru tradition, you are probably aware that in the West there has been a lot of pushback as to the whole idea of the guru. There have been enough situations where gurus or teachers have had scandals where there's been some accusation of misbehavior sexually or with money or power in some way. And a lot of people in the West have said, oh, the age of the guru is over. The guru principle is kind of part of the past, and we need to move on into something new that leaves that behind. What do you say to people who put that idea forward?
Definitely there have been shameful situations in the past. And such situations are there in every aspect of life. If there are corrupt people, there is corruption in all levels of life, in every profession, in every aspect of life. But when it comes to a spiritual process, this becomes very stark, because this is a process which happens where trust is the most essential factor. And when that is loosened, definitely there will be a huge sense of disappointment, which is what you're saying right now. The reaction is just a huge sense of disappointment in people. But that is only in the press and in the media and such situations. But among the people, I do not find anything like that at all. First of all, this whole idea of guru means he'll ask you to surrender to him and all these things are essentially being done because, in India, people's idea of United States is what they see in the B-grade movies that come from Hollywood. So the worst kind of trash from United States lands up in India. Similarly, unfortunately, the worst kind of trash from India tends to land up in United States, a part of it. Okay, we do get some good movies also, but a lot of trash lands up here. And similarly, the Indian trash lands up there. Because trash cannot make a living in the local area. Always it has to move to a new place. Right now, there are all kinds of healers from United States coming and claiming here that they can heal just about anything from cancer to this and that. And similarly, there are lots of people from India who are coming to United States and claim similar things. So I keep asking, why this Indo-American exchange of healers? They can as well practice in their own place. But it does not work in the local place because everybody knows who he is. So having said that, what is a guru? A guru is just a live roadmap. So should I use the roadmap or should I just throw it? Because the last time somebody gave me a wrong roadmap, does it mean to say I never use a roadmap in my life? Well, you can shift from a roadmap to a GPS, which GPS means probably Guru Positioning System. So when you are traveling uncharted terrain, it is sensible to travel with a roadmap in your hand. If you believe that because the last time somebody gave me a wrong direction, that means I'll never again take directions from anybody, I will do my own thing, well, that could be a very wasteful effort in life, because when you're traveling an uncharted terrain, it may so happen to you that to find a destination which is right next door, you may have to go around the world and come to that place and still not find it. So because this is a subtle difference, there is a subtle difference between what is interiority and what is external situation. So first of all, human beings need to understand this. This is the only distinction that they know. So right now, there is a tendency in the world if they have, if they want to look, if they want to look to something beyond, they always tend to look up. Looking up and looking down is not a reality in the sense. You're sitting on a round planet. Where are you, Terry? No?
I'm near San Francisco.
Yeah, you're in San Francisco at a certain latitude. So you're not sitting in the North Pole. The planet is round, you're not sitting in the North Pole, and the planet is spinning too. So whenever you look up, you obviously look up in the wrong direction. So nobody knows which is up and down in this cosmic space. Nowhere is it marked this side up. Nobody knows what is forward and backward. Nobody knows what is north and south. It is only a kind of a conspiracy among us. We, all of us, believe that this is it. This is up, this is down. But nobody really knows. There is only one thing that a human being can be certain of right now. You know what is inward and what is outward. This is the only distinction that you know. Otherwise, you don't know anything. And even this, just in case, if you happen to get enlightened today, even this distinction you will lose. Right now, that's my problem. I do not know which is me and which is you. And that's why I'm all over the world. So that one distinction that you are enjoying right now, you will lose that when you are enlightened. So this whole process needs to be handled with a certain guidance. Otherwise, you may spend a lifetime to realize something so simple. When I say something so simple, see, right now, whatever you're seeing around you, it feels like it's around you, but actually, if you're looking at a tree, or you're right now listening to me, you are not listening to me. This voice is happening inside of you. The way it happens within you is the way you know it. What you see is just light falling on something that you're seeing right now, and the way it reflects in your mind, that's how you see it. So what you see is within you. What you hear is within you. Light and darkness is within you. Pain and pleasure is within you. Agony and ecstasy is within you. Whatever you have ever experienced happens within you. You have never experienced anything outside of yourself. So the only thing that a human being knows is within himself, the way it happens within himself. But he believes it's happening all around him. The very source and basis of his experience is within, but he believes it's outside. So when he is in such a state of delusion, it is best that he seeks guidance from somebody who has traveled the path. So if in the past somebody has guided him wrong or misused him in some way, yes, he needs to be a little more careful, but not give up the help that is available. Otherwise, it will be an unnecessary waste of time. So the Western societies need to understand this. They have seen one or two bad apples. That does not mean you give up eating apples.
Well, thank you. Thank you so much, Sadhguru. I would love to just keep going with follow-up questions, but I know that there are many people listening to us who would like to join the conversation. So if you're listening via the web, you can go ahead and type out a concise question in the instant teleseminar window. I know a number of you already have. But before we begin to answer any questions, I have a few things I'd like to let everybody know about. First, Beyond Awakening is also being made possible and is presented free of charge by the generosity of our many wonderful sponsors, including the Institute of Noetic Sciences, or IONS. IONS invites you to join free so that you can explore the science of inner knowing. When you become a member of this conscious community, you connect with like-spirited individuals exploring three program areas that offer enormous potential for positive change: consciousness and healing, worldview transformation, and extended human capacities. IONS hosts a global community where people connect, learn, and transform through live and online programs. Membership is free, so sign up today at noetic.org. That's N-O-E-T-I-C, noetic.org. And Calling in the One. Join women's transformation and empowerment pioneers Claire Zammit and Catherine Woodward Thomas for a free 75-minute teleseminar, Calling in the One: How to Identify and Release Your Hidden Barriers to Love and Become Magnetic to Your Soulmate. On this free call, you'll discover what the hidden barriers to love are and how you can release them. Let Calling in the One show you how to move beyond old patterns in love and life so you can attract and sustain the kind of powerful, loving, and spiritual partnership that will catapult you toward the full realization of your destiny. Join Claire and Catherine this Monday, November 1st, for an exclusive, free, 75-minute teleclass and find out for yourself how to access the power to call in the one. For more information and to register, go to callinginthe1.com/teleseminar. That's callinginthe1.com/teleseminar. And Sadhguru's intensive retreat in Los Angeles this February. Sadhguru offers very few intensive retreats across the globe each year, so don't miss the precious opportunity to directly encounter Sadhguru in an intensive setting. His next intensive retreat in the United States is scheduled to take place in Los Angeles, California, February 3rd to 6th, 2011. Participants will have the opportunity to be initiated into the very ancient and powerful Shambhavi Mahamudra practice during this program. That's February 3rd to 6th, 2011 in Los Angeles. For more information, go to ishafoundation.org. That's I-S-H-A Foundation, ishafoundation.org. And finally, this Thursday, in just 2 days, at our regular time at 5 p.m. Pacific time, please be sure to tune in to the next dialogue in this series. I'll be talking with Sensei Diane Musho Hamilton. We'll be talking about dancing with the collective field of light and shadow. And I'll tell you a little more about that at the end of this call. Okay, now let's go to the question and answer section of this evening with Sadhguru. I see a question from Paula Rose in Perth, Western Australia. Sadhguru, how has self-transformation affected you personally as a human being? Sadhguru?
Yeah. It has not affected me, just who I was at that moment. It has completely evaporated who I am today. I think I should narrate this, how this happened. See, as a child and then as a youth, I grew up as a skeptic. I'm a super skeptic about everything. So if anybody has turned spiritual, I must be the last person on the planet. That's how I was. So on a certain afternoon, between two business meetings, I was running a construction company, and I was far more successful than people would have expected anyone to be. Generally, in a few years of business, I was hugely successful, and I was, you know, everybody's clapping their hands around you about your success, and slowly you're beginning to think the whole world is revolving around you. So I'm in that kind of a condition where I believe the planet goes around me, not around the sun. So that afternoon, I just, there's a small hill in the place where I was growing up, and I went up this hill. This is a hill that I know very well, and you know, like this is a place where I've camped, I've spent nights and days there, I've meditated there, and just I went and sat there that afternoon. And I just sat there with my eyes open, not even with my eyes closed. And what happened to me at that moment was, for the first time in my life, till then I was very, very clear what's me and what's not me. For the first time in my life, I did not know which is me and which is not me. What was me was all over the place. The very rock on which I was sitting, the air that I was breathing, the atmosphere around me, everything had turned into me. So that doesn't make sense because logically you, this is you and that is something else, and I did not know which is me and which is not me. I thought this lasted for about 5 to 10 minutes. But when I came back to my normal awareness or my normal sense of consciousness, about 4.5 hours had passed. I was sitting right there, and I thought it's about 10 minutes, and about 4.5 hours had passed. And for the first time in my adult life, I had tears flowing down my cheeks for the whole 4.5 hours, that my shirt was wet to that extent. When I really tried to shake my head and try to understand what was happening, the only thing that my logical mind could tell me was maybe I'm just going off my rocker. It looked like utter madness, what was happening to me. But it was such a fabulous madness, I didn't want to lose it for a moment. I've always been a peaceful and joyful person. That's not been an issue for me. And I've been, till that point, I was very successful with whatever I was doing. So I really did not know any problems in life. I was just doing fine. But this was something else. Every cell in my body was bursting with ecstasy, for which I had no explanation. All I knew was I didn't want to lose it. So this started happening more often. The next time it happened was far more significant because there were people around me. I actually sat down with my family at the dinner table, and I thought in my experience of just 2 minutes, and about 7 hours had passed, and I'm sitting right there. So what happened to me was suddenly time would just flip. I think it's 2 minutes, but hours have gone by. And on a certain day, I sat in a place and I thought it's about 25, 30 minutes, but 13 days had passed. I was sitting right there. By then, people had gathered, India being what it is. They were putting garlands around me, someone falling at my feet, someone wants to know about his business, someone wants to know when his daughters will get married. All the things that I hated were just happening right there around me. And in the next 6 weeks, what happened to me was so indescribable. The flood of memory that came to me was so overwhelming. And I just started traveling for a while just to be out of the space in which people knew me, because people started looking at me strangely because my voice changed dramatically within a few days. The shape of my eyes changed, my whole body got realigned, my gait just changed naturally, the way I walk. So the things that happened within me was too phenomenal, it is too phenomenal to articulate, but what people could observe from outside also is quite dramatic, that people couldn't believe that I'm changing so rapidly without any rhyme or reason. So what I can say is that person that existed till then, that young sapling man who was successful and was proud of his success and everything, that man just evaporated in those 6 weeks' time, completely. He vanished without a trace. So I cannot say I have changed. I just lost myself.
Mm. Thank you for telling us that story. That was really rich and beautiful. Well, we're having quite an international call. That was from that question came from Western Australia. Here's a question from Chetan in Paris. And Chetan asks, today for a lot of people, the path of spiritual practice seems to be something abnormal and illogical. It seems to me that this is so because the scientists have been accepted as the authority on what is real and how to live. People believe what the scientists say, regardless of whether they understand it or not. But unfortunately, most scientists regard spiritual practices as mere superstition. What can be done to transform this rigid outlook that scientists have towards spirituality in order to make spirituality seem more normal for the common person in Western cultures?
Yes, I think in many ways, science and scientific community, unfortunately, exists in a reaction to the misuse that has happened in the past. So before the modern times evolved the way it evolved in the last 150 or 200 years, there was a huge misuse of, people who are in positions of religious power, using people in so many illogical ways with all kinds of superstitions and exploitation, particularly in the European society, that the scientific community built itself in reaction to that misuse and exploitation. So naturally, they have been extremely, it's more than caution. They have been, I would say, almost reactionary in their approach towards anything beyond their logical understanding of life. But today, the modern physics is coming to a place where it is naturally looking towards a dimension beyond the logic to understand the existence. And many great physicists have articulated as much, saying that unless we delve into mysticism, there is no way to know the nature of this existence. Because everything that modern science is saying today, with a certain mathematical background and a certain logical exposition to the realities of the physical world, have been expressed, especially in the eastern part of the world, way before, thousands of years before. See, for example, do I have the time to quote? And
yeah.
Hello?
Yes, you do.
For example, a few months ago, someone was talking to me when I was in the United States, and they asked, if you have to name someone in the Western world who has played a significant role in shaping human consciousness, who is it? Who is it? Who would you name? I said, Charles Darwin, without hesitation. They said, he's a naturalist. How can he have played a role in human consciousness? I said, Charles Darwin is the person who put this idea into the Western mind that life can evolve beyond its present dimensions of existence, which is the basis of human consciousness. Otherwise, someone made you the way you are, and that's it. Either you're punished or you're rewarded somewhere, and that's all there is. There's nothing more you can do. The idea that a donkey can evolve into a giraffe if it strives, or a boar can evolve into an elephant if it strives over whatever amount of time. The possibility that a life can exist beyond its present dimensions of existence, that idea and that thought entered Western mind only with Charles Darwin. Having said that, this idea, this possibility has been a common vein of the Eastern cultures for thousands of years. Over 15,000 years ago, when Adiyogi came in the upper regions of Himalayas, this is the first thing he said. If the needed striving is there, the present dimensions of your physical existence are no more limitations. There is a way, there is a possibility to step beyond that. And he provided the necessary tools for that. And this was the first yogi, and that is how the science of yoga evolved from his exposition of how it can be done. Now, when I say going beyond your present dimensions of existence, see, for example, what we consider as time is so locked up in the logical limitations of the mind, and in many ways it's done wonderful things for us, because once you go into the illogical, once you try to touch a dimension beyond logic, then you need people of extreme integrity. Extreme integrity. Otherwise, misuse will naturally follow. So generally, the science that you see today is in reaction to that misuse, which was so rampant in various societies for a long time. It is a very common thing in India that our grandmothers told us, it is very important who serves you food, who prepares you food. It is extremely important, especially when it comes to water, from whom you receive the water that you drink. So probably in the last 25, 30 years, most of the younger generation has rejected this as just superstition. But today, modern scientists are saying that you can change the quality of the water without changing its chemical composition. Just with thought and emotion, you can rearrange the molecular structure of water, and it can either bring well-being or illness to you just by a single thought or emotion directed towards a certain body of water. So this is science. So right now, what was said in the tradition becomes superstition. What is said by the scientist becomes science. This approach has to change. But I can very much understand why they have this approach, simply because if you loosen up the logical examination of what is being said or offered, then all kinds of fanciful people will start talking ridiculous stuff, claiming that to be the truth. So a kind of tempering of the two is important. A kind of balance between the two is important, which is not an easy balance to arrive at. So I am not saying this with any resentment towards the scientific community. Scientific community has been a great help in stabilizing the situation for the spiritual process. It is for this reason that my offering of spiritual process happens as a science, as a technology, never as a teaching, never as a philosophy or a belief system, no flowery language, all cutting logic, because it has to fit into the scientific, it has to pass the test of scientific logic. Otherwise, it is not relevant in today's world. And this is also a limiting factor to some extent. Right now, I call this inner engineering. And it is such a, what do I say? It is quite an unromantic title. If we make it a little more artistic, it would be so much more beautiful. But in pursuit of beauty, you may lose the truth. So I prefer that today it is very technical. Inner engineering seems very technical in its title, not only in its title, but also in its approach. But the end result is anyway the same, so it should not matter. The scientific approach is safer because it ensures that the misuse of these things are minimized in the world, which is very, very important.
Thank you. That was a very deep and extensive answer. I've really appreciated this. You've gone to some very interesting places in answering these questions. And I'd like to give you a chance to hear the voice of some folks, not just at the end when we open up the lines. So if you have a question, please press star 2 on your telephone. And if you've called in on the telephone rather than listening over the web, that is. And please make sure that it's a question rather than a commentary. And if you do that, it'll give us time to respond. So we have a question here from, Krista Briney, I guess, in Potomac, Michigan. Go ahead.
Hello, thank you. This is Chris from Royal Oak, Michigan. And Sadhguru, thank you for answering these questions. My question is, what do you feel is the most important action we can take to end suffering?
Chris, it must be beginning to get cold out there in Michigan.
Not yet, but soon.
Oh, it must be wonderful fall time, very colorful fall time out there.
Beautiful.
So, what do you have to do to end suffering? You need not end suffering. You should just stop creating it, because suffering is the making of your mind. We face all kinds of situations in our life, but suffering is essentially your making. If you come to a deeper understanding of what I'm saying, you would not create suffering. So we're always thinking of life like this: how to create a problem and how to find a solution. Solutions are not needed if we stop creating problems. So suffering is 100% the making of your mind. You just have to take charge of your mind in such a way that it does not do what you do not want. If it takes instructions from you, it would naturally be in a pleasant condition. But right now it is not taking instructions from you, it is doing its own thing. You have a phenomenal, your situation is like this. You have a phenomenal computing machine in your hands, but without the keyboard. By accident, you're touching this and that, and things are happening. So a more conscious handling of the mind would definitely bring you to a place where you do not create suffering for yourself. Can I tell you a joke? Do we have the time?
We have
If you're willing to go a little late, which is what seems to be happening, I think many of our listeners will hang on with us. We seem to have a very big response to this discourse, Sadhguru, so please go right ahead.
On a certain day, a lady went to sleep. Chris, let's listen to this. On a certain day, a lady went to sleep. In her sleep, she had a dream. In her dream, she saw a hunk of a man standing there and staring at her. Then he started coming closer and closer and closer. He came so close to her, she could almost feel his breath. And she trembled, not in fear. And then she asked, "What will you do to me?" The man said, "Well, lady, it's your dream." Chris is not on the line.
Hi. I can see if we can draw him back onto the line.
That's fine.
Okay.
What I'm saying is, what's happening in your mind is your dream. At least your dream should happen the way you want it. The life situations may not happen the way you want them, exactly the way you want them. But if you learn to make your dream or what is happening in your mind the way you want it, largely you can also shape your life the way you want it. So suffering is not a natural happening. It is your making. If you understand this, you will stop making it.
Beautiful. We have quite a few other questions here, Sadhguru. Let me bring one from Narmada in Chennai. We have several questions from India. Narmada asks, "Should I believe in destiny? I feel that whatever I do, because of my own interests and efforts, later on I come to understand that it was destined. So if I have to blossom spiritually, won't that happen according to destiny too?"
Destiny is what you call as destiny is an unconscious creation of your own. The very source of creation is functioning within you. Destiny, when you say destiny, looking at the course that you have set for yourself, we can predict your destiny. But when the very source of creation is throbbing within you, it is not necessary to conclude that destiny or the process of destiny is a fatalistic process. It is not. It is something that you are actively creating, maybe unconsciously. Whatever you can create unconsciously, you can also create consciously. So spiritual process essentially means just this. It does not matter what my yesterday was. It does not matter what my genetic says. It does not matter what everything around me says. But if I choose to move towards my ultimate liberation, I get there. So this is, spiritual process is essentially about taking the very fundamental process of life and death into your hands. So please do not waste yourself with self-defeating ideas of destiny. Destiny is not a fixed thing. A destiny is something that you create.
Beautiful. Thank you very much. Well, we have quite a few other questions. I know I'd like to go on forever, but I think we have to finish up with one. I have Carol Bohannon from Topeka, Kansas on the line. Carol, you're live on the air.
Actually, I'm in Windsor, Connecticut. I guess my information is old. I have two daughters that it kind of sparked a question when you were talking about feeling connected and sometimes not knowing what part is you and what part is somebody else. I have two daughters that they experience that almost on a daily basis when they're around a lot of people. They're so tuned in that sometimes, you know, I have even noticed that they will start mimicking the feelings of somebody else. And it frustrates them a lot when they feel like that, because they say, you know, sometimes they don't know what feelings are theirs and what feelings are somebody else's. How do you deal with that?
Carol, the thing is, right now, both your daughters, you must pack their bags, send them to India immediately. Because there are any number of human beings who have come with a natural ability, or every human being, for that matter, has come with a natural ability to be spiritual. The only reason why humanity has not naturally become spiritual, every one of the human beings have not naturally turned spiritual, is because they are entrapped in their own logical situation, or they're too serious about their thought and emotion. When somebody takes his own thought and emotion seriously, he will disengage himself from the rest of the existence. So for whatever reason, your daughters, if they are experiencing something like this, without any guidance, without any external support, it could be very challenging for a human being, because without the necessary understanding and stability within yourself, if any big experience happens, it can lead to very, overwhelming situations which they cannot handle. So it's always best that these experiences are not pushed back, but rather you stabilize the nature of your existence in such a way that the experience can grow into your positive force in your life rather than being a nuisance. So that's why I said you must pack them up and send them.
I do have one. That's one place she has always been in love with the idea of going to India. So I dare not say that to her, because she'd be on the next plane if she had the money.
Well, thank you, Carol, and thank you, Sadhguru, so much for joining us. It looks like we're out of time for the Q&A, but we'll open up the lines here in a minute, and I'll let you know what's coming up over the next few days.
Thank you very much, Arita. I hope it's been useful to you and your listeners. Thank you very much.
I think it's been very rich, and you can hear many of their voices in just a minute if you choose to stay on the line. If you're interested in diving deeper into this conversation, please be sure and visit our blog at beyondawakeningseries.com/blog, and you can also join our Facebook group where you can discuss any of these topics at beyondawakeningseries.com/Facebook. Or you can just click on the links that we sent you in the email that you received earlier today. And you're invited to post comments about the dialogue today, and also any suggestions for questions for Thursday's dialogue with Diane Mushill-Hamilton or Sunday's dialogue with Brother David Stendel-Rast. And if anyone you know might be interested in this series, you can please forward them one of our emails so they can join us too, or invite them to register at beyondawakeningseries.com. To learn more about me and my work, please visit integralspiritualpractice.com. And I want to thank the partners who presented this program, Integral Spiritual Practice and Evolving Wisdom, and some of the sponsors who've made all this possible, especially the Sedona Method. Have you heard about the new movie called Letting Go? It will entertain and delight you and guide you into uncovering and living the truth of who you are. It's designed to support the worldwide awakening to truth that's already sweeping the planet. If you're already exploring the non-dual path, then you will find its insights enlightening and refreshing. It also gives powerful tools to use to introduce non-duality to those around you. Letting Go will give you practical tools you can use every day to let go of the anxiety, anger, frustration, and limiting emotions that prevent you from recognizing your true nature and that cause you to re-identify with the dream. As you watch this movie, it will make you laugh and cry as it deepens your own understanding and openness to your own intuitive knowledge. To order the film, visit lettinggo.tv/moviedvd. That's lettinggo.tv/moviedvd. And Inner Engineering Online. Inner Engineering Online is an ESHA preparatory course that participants can attend online that offers the possibility to explore the deeper dimensions of life under Sadhguru's guidance, the guidance of a true yogi and mystic. Participants will receive valuable and effective takeaway tools that have the power to dramatically open one to a life-transforming shift in perception. For more information and to register, go to innerengineering.com. And remember to please tune in 2 days on Thursday, October 28th, at our regular broadcast time, 5 p.m. Pacific. I'll be talking with Sensei Diane Musho Hamilton about dancing with the collective field of light and shadow. If we're truly seeing a new wave of consciousness, we really need to ask, how can we create a metta sangha of teaching and learning together? This requires cooperation, and it becomes important that what is emerging here is not a phenomenon about individual teachers or even those individual teacher-student relationships, as important as they might be. We also need to begin to have relationships as co-venturers on the path. Diane says, as a facilitator, there's almost nothing that can happen in a room that I don't feel comfortable working with, but when we talk about cultural transformation, I have more questions than answers. And yet, maybe some clues why in the dynamics of these collective fields right there in the room. So we'll venture into the field where we will hold these questions together and inviting new awareness in just 2 days. And then this Sunday, on Halloween morning, at 11 a.m., another different time, I'll be conducting another international interview that I'm very excited about. I'll be in conversation with Brother David Steindl-Rast, a deeply wise and wonderful Christian mystic and pioneer of interreligious dialogue and of an integral panentheist Christianity who really restores that heart of gratefulness every time you hear his voice. He'll be speaking with us live from Switzerland on Sunday, October 31st, Halloween at 11 a.m. Pacific time. So finally, it's time to open up our phone lines. I'd like to thank you for joining me, and let's all hear each other's voices.
Thank you.
Bye.
Thank you, Sadhguru. Thank you, Swami Shankar. Goodbye.